Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Eric Siegel, chair of the club's Personal Growth Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Our speaker is Lama Tsomo, who was born as Linda Pritzker into a Midwestern Jewish household and who got her master's in counseling psychology from Antioch. Over 20 years ago, she began a path of spiritual inquiry that ultimately led her to her ordination as one of the few American lamas in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. Today, she practices, teaches, and writes from her rural home in Montana, where she's also leading the development of a large-scale Tibetan Buddhist retreat facility. And she's the author of a new book, Why is the Dalai Lama Always Smiling?, which is designed to introduce Westerners to Tibetan Buddhist practices. The book offers step-by-step instructions on real, basic Tibetan meditation practices taught in a Western-style, accessible way, along with stories and jokes and tales of Lama Tsomo's personal journey. She's agreed to come to the club to provide a two-hour workshop that will first briefly introduce the benefits of meditation and then focus on teaching a beginner-level meditation. She will also share ways to sustain a meditation practice over time and will discuss how practicing and studying with others in a learning circle can be tremendously beneficial for personal and spiritual development. It is now my pleasure to ask you to join me in welcoming to the Commonwealth Club of California our speaker, Lama Tsomo.
Thanks, Eric, and thank you all for having me today. Thank you for opening the building on a Saturday, which I hear is very unusual, and I hear we might have broken the ice for more of that. Been doing a little research on the Commonwealth Club and was pleasantly surprised to discover that it exists. I knew nothing about it before. And I have an insatiable curiosity to learn about a lot of different things. And it sounds like you guys do too. And I was looking at some of the lineup of speakers and thinking, oh, I'd love to hear that or that one or that one, that kind of thing. So I feel honored to be invited to be one of the speakers. So everybody has busy lives, I know, and has taken the time, thank you, for spending these 2 hours together. And just to begin, I'd like everybody to be quiet for just a moment. You don't have to do anything special. Just settle in, being here, right now. So it may seem that you're doing nothing, but actually you're doing a couple of things. It's going to seem very simple, because it is. You're paying attention to this lady talking, for one thing. Yeah? So you're paying attention. There's something else you're doing. And I've got to tell you, you do it all the time. You do it standing, sitting, sleeping. You probably know what it is. Breathing. But how often do we notice? A lot is going on right in this moment, and we don't notice. And so we miss it. This is living. So that's one thing I discovered when I was first meditating. I discovered, my gosh, I'm missing a lot. But I also discovered, and it took me a lot longer to discover this, there's a lot of things that meditation isn't. So I'm going to tell you a few things that meditation isn't. One thing it isn't is being in a hypnotic state. Another thing it isn't is always being blissed out. A lot of people think, especially in California, maybe you expect that. In Montana, they haven't even heard about that part. And another thing people think is that you're supposed to stop your brain. You're not supposed to think. That's also not what it is. That was one, and the blissed out one, actually, that I thought were parts of meditation. I thought, yeah, maybe there's some kind of state like hypnosis. No, not that either. So you're probably hoping that I'm going to tell you what it is, and I am, but not right away. So just kind of the arc of our time together, I'll just quickly let you know what it is. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a story about me stumbling my way into meditation and hopefully getting better and better, and what that did for me, and why meditate anyway. And then I'll teach you how to meditate, shamatha meditation, very simple, calming and focusing the mind meditation. I'll teach it to you officially, not sneaking up on you like I did. And then there will be some question-answer, and then we'll go back to doing the shamatha meditation together just for a few minutes at the end. So first of all, I'd like to know, how many people do meditate somewhat regularly? Okay. Oh, good, because I'm doing an introduction, so a lot of you are in the right room, and I've got the right notes with me. So a little bit about my story. So I was pretty normal in running around chasing... You don't believe me. Okay, well, the masquerade's over already. Anyway, one way in which I was normal was running around chasing things I wanted, you know, grabbing after them, trying to hold on to them when they came. And, of course, that didn't work very well. Pushing away the things I don't want and, you know, trying to keep those away and worrying about it plenty. And it turns out that didn't work so well either. And so plenty of things that I wanted to have happen didn't, or they didn't continue. And plenty of things that I didn't want to have happen did happen. Ah, I can tell I'm not on the mountain in Montana. So I was doing this, occupying my mind with this really all day, every day. And even in my sleep when I was dreaming, I was still basically doing the same thing. So I personally had more of a sort of a longing for things, you know, wanting this or that mentality. Some people are more of the pushing away or competitive or that sort of end of things. But my nature was to have a really serious case of the what I call if-onlys. So if only this person liked me, if only that would happen, if only such and such. So I was often practicing the if-onlys, and it wasn't doing me a lot of good, and it certainly wasn't helping me to be right here, right now, living this moment. And so moment by moment was really kind of slipping through my hands. So a big theme I'm going to be talking about today is living a meaningful life. And I wasn't doing a very good job of it. So the other thing was that I wanted to be a better, happier person, speaking of meaningful life. This was something that I just basically wanted for myself. And I discovered, as I studied psychology and talked with a lot of people, many people wanted the same thing. In fact, even people who seemed to claim that they didn't want to be happy, when I actually sort of dug into it, I found that what they were doing was still trying to pursue something that was making them happy. For example, many of us sign up for challenging situations. That doesn't mean we don't want to be happy. those challenging situations usually are in service of bringing something to another. And actually, that is what makes most of us happy, is helping others, even when it's not easy, even when it's really challenging. I'm going to be talking more about that. So I decided to try meditation. It just seemed like a good, helpful thing to do. I was living in dairy country in Wisconsin, where there were more cows than people, and there were no meditation teachers. So I read a couple of books and sat every night with my then husband, and we steadfastly meditated our 15 to 20 minutes every night after the kids went to bed. We managed to stay awake, but I don't know that our meditations were so good. As a matter of fact, I became more and more convinced that I was wasting my time. I was probably meditating really badly. And I think it was partly because of those misconceptions that we talked about earlier. So after years of doing this, I stopped. And I spent 5 years not meditating on a daily basis, really not meditating at all. And then I kind of came to one day and realized, wait a second, I'm really off track in my life. How did this happen? And I realized that little by little, infinitesimal decision by decision during the course of a day, and we have thousands of those when you think about it, I was getting a little off track. Why? Because I wasn't coming back to myself. I was always sort of responding to what was happening on the outside instead of turning the lens inward. What was happening in my meditations, even the bad ones, and they were pretty crummy, I've got to tell you, but they were an attempt, and what was happening was the lens was turned inward. So I was there to notice when a thought would bubble up that was like, oh, I need to do such and such. I've been kind of letting that slip by the wayside. Or some feeling about somebody, oh, this is how I really feel. And then letting it go, because I would, you know, say to myself, oh yeah, I was meditating. And so then I would go back to meditation. So it was, you know, kind of like that eight ball when you turn it over and something bubbles up and you read it and it's profound. Well, it was sometimes profound and sometimes not, but it turned out that that was helpful. And the very process of turning the lens inward and checking in with myself every day was much more significant than I could have guessed. And the only way I knew it was by doing my own personal experiment and not doing it for 5 years. So there I was, really off track. And I thought, well, I need to do daily meditation again, but I want to do it better. So having studied piano as a kid, I knew very well that if you want to get good at piano, you find a good piano teacher and you study with them, and then you practice every day. So I thought, well, the same principle should apply. So I decided I would sort of sound the note in my meditations. I want to find my teacher. And hopefully now that I'm getting back in touch with myself, I'll recognize when that right teacher for me comes along. And I was really methodical about it. My dad was into science and had a love of science and taught me a love of science. And I still subscribe to Scientific American and have read a lot of scientific studies about the benefits of meditation, too. But anyway, so I was methodical, and I wrote a list of things I did want and didn't want. So I didn't really care so much what flavor, what, you know, lineage the person came from or whatever, but that this was somebody bona fide, that they really knew what they were doing, that they were very accomplished at meditation, that they were proof of the pudding in the kind of person they were, you know, just their character. And I listed a bunch of other things. And you know, knowing the scholarly background was another one. Something I forgot to mention on the list: must speak English. Be very careful what you wish for. So I got everything on my list, and things that weren't on my list, I didn't get. So I got a Tibetan Lama who was extremely accomplished at many things, but not English. So I ended up having to learn Tibetan to be able to communicate with him. And interestingly, learning Tibetan, learning a language, first of all, I wouldn't recommend learning Tibetan if you don't have to. It's a very difficult language. Completely different alphabet and so on, different sounds, different order of words in the sentence. But it was a great metaphor for training our minds the way we're trying to with meditation. So the first thing I did was give up. I'll never learn meditation. And by then I was in my mid-40s. I'll never live in Tibet, I thought, so forget it. But I thought, well, if I just knew a few words, that would be nice. And then I could just communicate directly with him. So I learned just a few words. And one word led to another. And because he never learned English, I did eventually learn Tibetan. I did a few minutes every day of a simple home course. And then I had total immersion experiences when Rinpoche was with me, or his attendant often was around, and so then I could practice my Tibetan with her. But every day I would have imaginary conversations with him, and of course they would be in Tibetan because he doesn't speak English. So I was practicing it every day. That's really important. And I was practicing in total immersion once in a while and with others. So these are all the elements, it turns out, for setting new pathways in the brain, getting the brain to orchestrate itself, the different parts of itself, in new ways. And there are a lot of scientific experiments that talk about how we even grow desirable parts of the brain, and the knee-jerk reaction part, the amygdala, actually gets measurably smaller. And there are some benefits that happen quickly over a period of even just a couple of weeks, and more long-term benefits and even stronger benefits when people do a lot of meditation for a long time. So I'm not going to go into a lot of that. And by the way, did you know that multitasking is even improved, measurably improved by meditation, which seems like an oxymoron, except that we actually only pay conscious attention to one thing at a time and we're shuttling. And so meditation actually does help with that, because we pay attention to something, then if a thought arises, we come back, we let go, we watch our breathing as it's going along, and we keep letting go of the moment that just happened before, and we're in this moment here. So to me, it's not surprising, actually, that multitasking works better when you're able to just stay in the flow of the present. So I'm coming at this from a different angle, though, today. I want to talk about it more from the point of view of living a meaningful life. So first of all, what is that? And why do we want to do it? So at first, my goal that I had in mind was I want to help people be better, happier people. I know I want that. It seems like everybody else wants that. So I studied psychology, because that seemed like the best way to help people be able to pursue that. And so after studying the best of the West and getting an MA in counseling psych, and then having a practice and writing a book on Jungian-style fairy tale interpretation and so on, I then found my way to this Tibetan Lama. His name is Gochen Tuku Sangak Rinpoche, and you don't have to repeat that back. But anyway, he is the head of the Namchok lineage, and Namchok is the name of our organization because that's the name of our lineage. Anyway, So I did notice in my practice as a psychotherapist that people did want their lives to count for something. No matter who was sitting on the chair and talking to me, they all wanted their lives to count for something. And it seemed that without fail, that meant helping others in some way. I was just listening to the story of a fellow whose son was killed by a gang when he was delivering a pizza. And he was thrown into the practice of forgiveness. And he did it primarily for himself because he couldn't bear the resentment. Turns out that of all the kinds of stress that we have, the one that threatens our longevity the most, not to mention our happiness, is holding a grudge. So this fellow discovered that on the front lines, and he practiced forgiveness, was able to forgive, and now leads, he's devoted his life entirely to helping people on both sides of gang violence, the gang members who fall into being in gangs for reasons that I think we all know about. And so in a sense, they are victims of things. And then the relatives of victims of gang violence. And he's leading the most satisfying and fulfilling life, as he tells it, because of doing this. So I call that a redemption story in a way. And I think we're all on some redemption story or another. Something we've felt pain about, we now want to help others so they don't have to feel that pain. Or maybe it's just giving people joy. My son is a musician, and he loves to get people all excited on the dance floor and just feeling an evening of joy and a little break from their lives, whatever else may be going on in their lives. So one way or another, it seems everybody wants their life to count for something by helping others in some way. The Dalai Lama says something in various ways, but he says this basic theme again and again. If you want to be miserable, work for your own happiness. If you want to be happy, work for the happiness of others. So why is that? How does that work? There is a metaphor from Buddhism that's quite ancient. I told it to my rabbi. He loved it. He said, "Did you make that up?" And I said, "No, it's from Buddhism. It's very old." He said, "Well, I want to use that." So I think it's a kind of a universal image. It's like the source of everything, you and me and just everything that we see. There's one common source. I refer to it as this pregnant emptiness. So it's like an ocean. And that ocean, by its very nature, just likes to make waves. It makes countless waves. I would say billions and billions, except did you know that Carl Sagan never really said that? I think he was a little annoyed. Anyway, we can't possibly count the numbers of waves on the ocean, and no two are exactly alike. And when they go down and they come up again, they're different again. They're constantly changing. So here is this one big ocean and all of these waves. But can we say that one wave is separate from the ocean or from all the other waves? So if this is the way it really is, then no wonder we feel we want to help others because we're connected to them at the root. So the best part of ourselves is that vast purity. Some people call it the great mystery. Actually, my rabbi preferred calling it the mystery rather than God because of all the connotations and associations with the word God. So if we call it this one great mystery source out of which we all come, that's who we really are. And that's perfect, and it's perfectly aware. It's certainly not this dumb vacuum. It's aware, and we're all aware. Of course we would be, because we're part of that ocean. That ocean is also perfect compassion and love. If you think of it, if you knock your shin against the coffee table, your whole self is in pain. Your whole self suffers. Likewise, at the root, everything registers, all pain and all love, because there's just one of us, really. At the same time, there really are all these waves, and every wave is unique. And so I believe that we come into this life wanting to be sure that whatever gifts we bring as this wave, we want to share for the benefit of everybody, all the waves, the whole ocean. And so, unfortunately, we get kind of distracted. And I got especially distracted during that 5 years when I wasn't meditating. And I found that when I started meditating with instruction, I got more and more and more on track. I got more and more effective at bringing what I came to this life to bring. And in challenging situations, I was more able to be effective, to bring the loving, compassionate presence that is actually my essence, just as it's the essence of that person, and feeling how we're not separate. Because I've been practicing, I've been exercising those muscles every day, and sometimes in retreats for months at a time, at weeks at a time, and so on, for many years. So it's in those moments when homework pays off. Trust me. So how do you know what your gifts are and what your note is to sound in the world? Because there's only one of you, and it's your particular note, which the world needs. We don't want to miss it. And how do you stay on track in a day-to-day kind of way through those thousands of decisions that I was talking about before? So again, I was able to stay on track and get more and more on track and be more and more effective with daily meditation and sometimes doing retreats. That's what we call the total immersion programs when it's not Berlitz, but it's about meditation. We call it retreats. So why is it that, how does it work that meditation would help us to stay on track? So the metaphor that I really like, and again, I can't say I invented it, is if you're sitting by the side of a pond, if the pond is all stirred up, then there's all this silt in the water and there's waves and everything, it's going to be very hard to see, first of all, the nature of the water itself, and you're not going to be able to see through to the bottom. So if you just let things settle out a little bit, it gets clearer and clearer. And then you can see both the nature of the water, which the water itself is perfectly clear, as is our true nature of our minds, without all the clutter. And we can see to the bottom. So then we can know what our true nature is and what our particular gifts are to bring to the world, what we came here to do in this life. So the other thing that, how can I say this? The other muscles you exercise are muscles that have to do with feeling our connection with others. So there's the insight piece, the insight wisdom piece, I would say, that I was just describing about seeing clearly to the bottom of the pond. But then there's also feeling how we're not separate. We can see the whole ocean. We can see how we're not separate. But then to bring the warmth of love and compassion that are also qualities of this pregnant emptiness, this source, this great mystery. And we are made of that too. So if we exercise that muscle as well, then those two things together, wisdom and compassion, become a great force for the good. We become a great force for the good. I think of people like Martin Luther King, the Dalai Lama. I think of Desmond Tutu, Nelson Mandela. We can think of many great, powerful forces for the good who had both of those in great measure, wisdom and compassion. Wisdom without compassion is rather cold, and it can also cause a lot of trouble. We can be very smart, but without compassion, we can do things like create an atom bomb. And on the compassion side, without insight and wisdom, it can be a little bit like a friend of mine who just says yes to everybody. They always know to ask him for money, because if he has any money at all, he just gives it to that person. And so he's always broke. He's now living with a family, and she doesn't dare keep the money anywhere near him because they wouldn't be able to pay the bills. And I just don't think he's able to be as great a force of good in the world as he could be if he also brought the insight and wisdom piece. He certainly has a good heart. So those two things together, I feel, are a winning combination, extremely important. Barbara Fredrickson wrote a book called Positivity, and she cites a lot of studies in that book. One study that they did really surprised them. So they believed in the benefits of meditation, and they were getting some kind of okay results. But when they talked to people about doing a heartful meditation, like a heart-opening meditation, suddenly the benefits to longevity and mind benefits, body benefits, everything skyrocketed. It was a huge difference, and it sustained over time. They tested them many months later, and the benefits still held. So in Vajrayana Buddhism, which is the one practiced in Tibet, we begin every session by stopping and remembering, what is my real motive for doing this? And bring it into an altruistic motive, which we don't have to fight to do, because I have found time and again that when we really get down to it, we want to do the meditation because we want to do ourselves better, our lives better, have a meaningful life, and that means helping others, and we want to be more effective at helping others. So that's altruistic. So we just need to get down to our real motivation, and that empowers the meditation by many times. Stephen Post, have any of you heard of Stephen Post? Well, he wrote a book called Why Good Things Happen to Good People. Yeah. And he cites a longitudinal study there that Paul Wink really grabbed a hold of and put forward. It was done at Wellesley College, and it was done over the course of 50 years. So they had a chance to look at people living a meaningful life, and it turned out once again that people who were doing altruistic behaviors in high school, by the end of the 50 years, these were the people who were healthier, happier, and more satisfied with their lives. They had just as many challenges as the control group, but they even saw the challenges in a very different light. And we all know this. If I'm feeling good about my life, that I'm really contributing, then if I find challenges along the way, that's okay. I'd rather not have them, I suppose, but we just actually rise to the challenges. And people have even been measured to have endorphins engaged when they are in the act of going through something difficult in order to help another. So that makes sense to many of us. And I think this is the right place for me to be talking about this, because I have a sense that everybody here feels the same way. So what's my offering to the world? Well, just like anybody else, it's various things. But the biggest is that, you know, I thought I had to wait until I was middle-aged before I came upon these methods that are so effective and have helped me in so many ways. So, and also I had to, you know, work with this Lama who doesn't speak English and all those other things and go to Nepal sometimes and so on. Wouldn't it be wonderful if I could share these things with Americans so that they could learn it in English, American style, hear some science tidbits because we're devout believers in the religion of science. And I am too. Actually, so is the Dalai Lama. He, Carl Sagan and he had a conversation one time, and Carl Sagan asked him, you know, I'll just paraphrase the conversation. So I understand you're a big supporter of science, but what if science goes against something that you've learned from Buddhism? And the Dalai Lama, who I can't do good imitations of him, so you'll excuse me, the Dalai Lama said, well, then I would have to accept it. And Carl Sagan said, yeah, but what if it's really a basic tenet of Buddhism? Like reincarnation. That's so basic. How would you deal with that? Oh, well, I would have to accept it if you disproved reincarnation. But you're going to have a lot of difficulty doing that. So I wanted to write a book. Now, I have to tell you, originally my plan in writing a book was just to have a little guidebook that people in my weekly study group could use because, you know, they need to refer to something at home, and I have more time to even go into things more than in those sessions we would have. B, I got tired of their asking the same questions again and again because this is so new that, you know, it's like, oh, if I could write this down, I can tell them, page 43. So as you can tell, I had a very lofty motivation for writing the book. But as I began to write it and got into it then more and more, I thought, I would love to be able to give to people what I couldn't have when I was really in my 20s and my 30s and my 40s, is to have a Westerner just say in plain English, this is what meditation is and this is what it is, this is some background, tell some stories and bring in some science and so on. So I began putting a book together. And what I wasn't going to do was talk about myself at all, but my illustrious editor, who happens to be sitting in the room today, worked very hard and patiently to convince me that people, Westerners, seeing another Westerner kind of step by step stumbling their way into this would be helpful. And being a good Jungian, the Jungian psychology was probably my favorite of all the modalities I studied, I knew that a picture is worth a thousand words. And so understanding what this very intimate relationship with one's Lama is like is best described by describing the story of my stumbling into it. I didn't know what it was. And it turns out to be a different kind of primary relationship than anything I had known about and been told about, experienced. And so I began to give a sense of that by just telling my story in meeting my Lama, getting to know him, studying with him, and so on, and gaining a huge amount of benefit. So I'm not going to go into all of that right now, but just to say, as I sort of went on this adventure of writing this book, it was going to be just this little guidebook, and it got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and I was like, wait, there are too many pages for one book. So I actually realized I'm writing three books. So the one that is outside the doors here and that we talked about in the beginning is the first of a series of three books. And it's the introductory one. So that's how I came to write the book. But then I didn't want to release the book and not have a way for people to follow through, because this was the other key thing that I noticed with so many students and could easily have happened for me. If we don't have all that we need to be able to step by step go along the path and follow through, then a few weeks of inspiration reading the book aren't going to do us much good. Because the key with changing the pathways in the brain and strengthening those pathways and getting the different parts of the brain to dance together differently, that's something that happens with daily practice. And the practice of doing daily practice is probably the most difficult one of all and the most essential. Because, of course, you won't get the other ones if you don't get that one. So my advice to people is to find, what are you doing every day anyway? What's in your routine anyway? And insert a few minutes. For starters, that's all you're ready for at this point. You know, how many bicep curls can we do the very first day? So we're not trying to get sore. We're just trying to, you know, not drive ourselves crazy on the cushion, but just begin and find a way that we can sustain. And then our capacities can grow and grow and grow. Mine certainly did. They went from a few minutes a day to now I can sit in a retreat where most of my waking hours I'm doing meditation practice. So that's one element. Another element is practicing with others, talking about it with others, having a small circle. We tend to like to call these learning circles. You could call it a book club. But the important thing is community. And again, I didn't make this up either. The Buddha found that there were three basic elements that were important. They're known as the three jewels because they're considered so very important. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So if you embark on a journey, first of all, you want a guide who's been there before, so you can be sure you're, you know, headed in the right direction. So that's the Buddha. Dharma is like the map. The teachings are like the map. And then Sangha is the community of people, the fellow travelers who are traveling along together. What I found again and again with these groups that I was leading was that if somebody decided, oh, I don't need to go to the weekly group anymore, pretty soon they fell away and they stopped doing the daily practice. And therefore, they got no benefit of the practice. So it really is a key piece of it. But the other thing is, it's really satisfying to sit with other people who are chewing on the same things together. And each person has very different circumstances in their lives. And as each person talks to the group about, well, here's this really challenging thing that's going on for me in my life, everybody else is really with them in that. And there is the kind of deep contact with each other that doesn't often get to happen in life, not nearly as much as we'd like. So part of a satisfying life is satisfying community. And being a psychotherapist, I also was aware that a lot of community is not so satisfying because we're not so skillful. And where do we get taught that? We never get taught how to do ourselves well in community. So the meditation practices can help us to do ourselves well internally. And that's actually going to help when we then go to interact with others. But there are also tools from more modern Western side of things that really help us to be able to do ourselves well in community with each other. And we might call it enacting Buddhism, engaged Buddhism. And furthermore, then if the groups can take that out into the world and bring benefit to the world, then that's yet another level of engaged Buddhism. And I feel strongly about inner and outer work supporting each other. The inner work helps the outer work to go better. The outer work, because now you're enacting this stuff and you're acting in an altruistic way, it comes back to benefit your work on the cushion as well. So this is what I would call a virtuous cycle. Excuse me. So even though I'm going to confess to you, I finished writing the book about a year ago. I didn't want to just sort of throw it out into the world and give people, you know, like I said, a couple of weeks of inspiration and then nothing. So we have now a revamped website, completely revamped, and there you'll find that it's namchok.org. Maybe I should spell that. Might just possibly help. I think it might be, yeah, on the handout. So you'll find our ways to get to us, social media as well as our website there. So we developed an online course. It's an 8-week course. You get a present in your inbox once every week for 8 weeks. And you get to learn 3 basic practices and some background as well, so that you can road test these methods. Those same 3 practices are also described at more length in the book. So you really get much more background, much more about each of the practices. But one of the practices really requires that you look at a video, so that for that you can just go to our website and watch the video. There's just a 2-minute video on that. We also support learning circles and have a toolkit, so that if you decide you want to start one, it's just an easy way to start it. You download the toolkit, bring healthy norms and just some very basic skills to the group. And everybody in the group, I would recommend, read the toolkit so that everybody's kind of on the same page. And if here in this community people want to start little living room learning circles, when I come back, which should be roughly twice a year to the Bay Area, I'm very interested in meeting with the learning circles. And when I meet with a learning circle, I talk to each person individually. And when I talk to this person, everybody else is listening. It's known as fishbowl in psychology circles. And so everybody learns from everybody, but everybody gets a little bit of one-on-one. So until I get too busy and there are too many learning circles, I'm open to meeting with learning circles when I come back. So you might consider it. We're also starting a 2-year intensive program for people who are already regularly meditating and want to deepen their practice. And we're hoping, we will be developing, beyond the toolkit, training for anybody to come and learn some of these group dynamic skills and personal leadership. And we have the help of Aaron Stern, who is the founder of the Academy for the Love of Learning. And he has developed a fantastic set of tools that dovetail very nicely with the set of tools that I bring from Tibetan Buddhism. And we work very closely together. So we're hoping to offer, let's say, an all-day workshop. Who knows, it could be a Saturday, for example. I'm nothing if not subtle. So when I was writing the book, I was speaking to my younger self who wanted a book like this and couldn't find it. And I think that there are wonderful resources in our society in both age groups, younger people and older people. So there's a benefit to experience and the gaining of wisdom, and I've certainly been very busy doing that. And there's a wonderful benefit to being at the beginning of your adult life and being able to see what's just over the horizon that's going to come this way, and knowing that in your bones, and having the energy and altruistic intention to really manifest that. And so I think with those two age groups being able to come together, that's another powerful force for the good. And I believe that's the natural way of humans. In the village, people weren't segregated into classrooms and so on and so forth, and watching their own, you know, TV channels and all this kind of thing. Everybody was just together. And so I think this benefit and this mutual respect was able to happen much more organically. And I think it's what we're designed for socially. And so this is a way that perhaps in this club such a thing could be demonstrated. I think the potential is really there, and I don't know how much it's realized. My guess is that it already is to quite an extent. But imagine, I mean, of course, if you're paying attention to something and using the tools to make it happen, it's usually going to happen more fully and more effectively if you bring all of that to it. So the saying that I like to quote is, if you aren't aiming at a target, you're probably likely not to hit it. So here's a target that's worth aiming for. And there are tools to help actually hit it. So now we've come to the actual shamatha section. And I'm noticing that there doesn't seem to be a lot of air, movement of air in the room. And I'm afraid everybody's going to fall asleep. Yeah, it's hot and
it's a Saturday. We're not normally here.
So the air is taking a weekend?
Yeah, the air is taking a break.
Oh, okay. I thought it was more constant than that. Yeah, maybe so, but I'm also noticing that the air wasn't moving, so. Yeah, it sounds great. I don't know. It feels like it's already, like I can feel the air moving. Okay, so there's a better chance we'll all stay awake. So two things that are considered threats to shamatha meditation are, on the one hand, get dullness and stupor and falling asleep, and the other is the mind being really agitated and jumping all over the place. I'm here to attest to the fact that it is possible to have both. I've done it many times. What we are trying to do instead is to have the mind be focused, vivid, aware, and yet calm and settled. And there's a great practice to help with the energies that the mind rides on, the chi or prana, whatever word you know. And we work with that, but that's not what we're going to talk about today. But that helps you get right into that state, or certainly much closer to it. But even without that, and most lineages in Buddhism don't even use that practice, we can still get to that state. And, well, you know, it's always more or less. You know, then you're going to find that you keep forgetting and remembering and forgetting and remembering. Oh, yeah, I was meditating. But that moment of saying, oh, yeah, I was meditating, is actually more self-awareness than you've had probably for the rest of your life. Because normally we're running around like a puppy, you know, just sniffing anything that's in front of it. And that's kind of how our minds usually are, waking and sleeping. It's actually kind of exhausting to think of. And again, we're chasing after these things that we want and trying to hang on to them, and we're trying to push away those things we don't want and worried about them and making plans and all this. All of that is rather exhausting when we think about it. And it's not about what's happening right now. One famous occurrence at shamatha retreats is that people sit there chewing their food in bliss, very slowly savoring a bite of food. Because they've slowed their mind down enough, they're noticing, oh my gosh, the texture. Oh my gosh, this and that flavor. Wow. And then as I'm chewing, this is happening. You know, and they're just, who needs drugs? It's just shamatha. Many people have talked about, you know, standing at a tree and going, I've never really experienced a tree. This tree is amazing. And I sit there quite often staring at my mountains because I live on a foothill and these mountains are like right in my face. And sometimes when I'm just busy eating and catching up on emails while I'm eating and the mountains are there, of course, I don't notice them at all. But then in my morning meditation, I'll look up and go, oh my gosh, look at the way the clouds are playing with the mountains. Oh. So it is possible to be in this moment, at least for a moment. And then we forget, and then we remember again. And so that we bring our minds back. So the handout that I've given you is a picture of what your brain is doing when you forget and remember. Isn't that great? And so while I was beating myself up in those early attempts at meditation, I didn't realize that's what I was doing. I was doing a bicep curl for the brain, as Dan Harris says. He wrote 10% Happier. Have you anybody read that? Great book. Very accessible. Very much his story about stumbling into meditation and its benefits. Anyway, so that's what the bicep curl for the brain looks like in sort of color-heightened graphic. So rather than studying that right now, because you can look at the small words later, I'll just tell you the overview. Okay, normally our minds are, like I said, like a puppy dog, sort of wandering around, sniffing whatever comes by its nose, and following after this scent, and following after that scent, that kind of thing, and then smelling some more. So that's how we normally are. So that is depicted as the distracted phase of the four phases that they're showing in the handout. But it's only one of four. Normally we specialize in that one. That's the only one we do. But in this case, there's the second one that goes, oh yeah, I was meditating. So the noticing is already awareness. And then the next thing we do is focus again on our breath or whatever it is was the object of our focus for that meditation. So bringing it to the object of meditation is the next phase. The last phase is holding it there. And then we get distracted again. Then we go, oh yeah, I was meditating. We bring it back to the object of awareness and then hold it there as long as we can. And if you can hold it there for a whole breath, great. If not, and you realize, oh, I've been following after a thought, great, you remembered. That's a good thing. That's more awareness than you've been having for however many years you've been alive. And you just bring it back. So you get to do the cycle again and again. And here's the other good thing. When you bring it back, that moment of fresh coming back to settling in shamatha is much more fresh and vivid and alive and fully present than if it's just going on and on and on and gets kind of like a little bit stagnant, you know. So it's fine to do that cycle. And just, you know, you hope that you haven't spent too much time making movies in your brain and wandering around before you realize, oh yeah, I was meditating. So that's what we're trying to do, is remember sooner, have it happen less often, so that now that pond I was describing, the waters are kind of calming, the silt begins to settle a bit, and we get to experience who we really are. I think one reason people have trouble with self-esteem is because we don't know that we are a part of this vast ocean. It's just the vast ocean shaping itself in this wave. And if we knew that, why would we have self-esteem problems? But also, we'll know, okay, this is the shape of this wave, and this is how I can contribute to the rest of the ocean. It's going to be a subtle thing, but it's going to be cumulative. That's what I discovered when I didn't meditate for 5 years, and when I did meditate for years. And I think you might find the same thing to be true. This is deceptively simple. I'm going to now give you the instructions. And please don't be disappointed. It's not fancy. It's not complicated. Okay, so all of you are breathing. That's good. That's the main thing. If you're not breathing, you don't need to do this anymore. The other thing is sitting comfortably. And you don't have to sit cross-legged. You may. It's going to be difficult in chairs. You know, putting your knee in somebody's lap may not be socially acceptable in this context. But I requested this chair so I can sit cross-legged. And I like to sit cross-legged when I meditate. So if you want to sit cross-legged and you can, great. If you can't, that's just fine too. The point is that your back needs to be straight. And when I say straight, I don't mean, you know, like in the military. But rather, imagine a marionette hanging from the ceiling from a string that's coming out the sort of back top of the head. So if I'm a marionette hanging from the ceiling from that spot, then my chin comes down a bit, right? Down and back a bit, just a little bit. And now my back is straight but very relaxed. I mean, we've seen marionettes, right? They're very, very flexible, supple. Supple is often the word used for the spine in shamatha. So our spines are just relaxed, straight, supple. We're not like tensing up or rigid, just being like that marionette. And we actually like to, for reasons of chi or prana, making sure that those settle a bit, in my tradition, we like to have the tip of the tongue touching the upper palate where it meets the teeth, the upper teeth, and the mouth is a little open, and we breathe through the mouth. There are particular channels going through the nose, and we want those to be very, very calm. So that's why we just have the air gently coming in and out of the mouth. And then all we have to do is pay attention to the breathing. And if possible, not even so much labeling it, I am breathing, but more really getting into the ongoing experience of it. So, for example, one thing I like to notice is the movement of my belly. The ongoing experience of it being this way as it moves, and that way. And the eyes are gazing downward. This also helps to calm, settle the mind a bit. You might notice the coolness across your tongue as the air passes over it. taking care that your eyes are looking down, but your face isn't facing downward. In effect, the eyes are half closed. And if a thought comes, you let it go. Those are also waves that go up and down. And we just let them. While we pay attention to the movement of the belly, or the air across our tongues. Or perhaps the ribs moving. Again, thoughts coming up and down are just fine. We let them come and go. We don't have to think about this or that one, any of them, right now. If you find that you're getting a little dull and sleepy, lift your gaze just a bit. Take a deeper breath. Bring extra oxygen to your brain. Or maybe instead your mind is following after thoughts and making movies, being way too active, agitated. In that case, lower your gaze a bit. And you might try just savoring the moment between in-breath and out-breath. Out-breath and in-breath. That perfectly poised, silent moment. Just savoring it for a moment. One thing that also helps is focusing your mind in your heart, which is where the Tibetans and most people of the world believe it to mostly reside. But as you focus it there, the brain does seem to settle. And some kind of opening seems to happen. So the mind, the heart, and the breath are somehow brought together. So from its seat in the heart, the mind pays attention to the breath. If you feel you need to shift positions a little bit or scratch an itch, in our tradition, that's acceptable. When you find you've been following after a thought rather than letting it come and go, you've probably found that you've made a whole movie around it. That's how we make this movie we call real life. Most of it is just this making movies, following after thoughts. And so you just practice the cycle we talked about. Noticing, bringing it back to the breath, and resting it there. Again and again, exercising those parts of the brain. And this habit of working with your brain. And you can use sounds coming and going, or even constant ones, as your object of meditation. Object of support is what we call it. You need to renew the straightness of your spine or the position of your head. It often helps. Now you could just savor these last few moments. Resting your mind on your breath. That's all you have to do. So perhaps you're feeling a little bit different from before you came here and sat down today. If you have a pencil and paper, you might jot down just a few adjectives, a couple of words that would describe how you're feeling right now. And if you don't have a pencil and paper, just go inside and notice, how am I feeling right now that might be different? I really did this just so I could put my shoes back on. So now turn to your neighbor and describe to them what your experience was of yourself after doing this. Or if somebody isn't nearby, see if you can find somebody behind you or in front of you or somewhere. I think this person doesn't have anybody to... Yeah, 25 minutes.
We tried 4 o'clock. We missed a couple of days. And when we're here, as far as down here,
so if one of you is talking more and the other one hasn't gotten a chance to say something, then the other person, please talk. Okay, so both of you got to talk in your dyads? Because, I mean, it's okay to keep talking. I just want to make sure that both people got a chance to talk. Equal airtime. Continue. Uh-huh. Okay, now it's time to come back up here with your attention. And we've come to the question and answer part of this. And already there are some good questions. So one question is, how is meditation different from Buddhism? Is it a religion? So when I was first this Jewish person studying meditation with a Tibetan Lama, the first thing he told me practically was, I'm not giving you a religion. I'm giving you a set of tools by which you can pursue enlightenment. And for him, that was sort of an ultimate goal. But basically, I was thinking in terms of just better and better, happier and happier person, more and more able to be a force of good in the world, which was what I found satisfying. So I was happy to hear that. There was a moment at which, and I talk about this in the book, I was sitting in the privacy of my own home doing meditation practice in the morning, and I thought, oh my gosh, I know more Tibetan words than Hebrew. What's happening? Oh my gosh, who am I? And then, you know, I kind of chewed on that a little bit, but very quickly I realized, well, I'm still me, this Jewish person, doing this. And I know a lot more Spanish than Hebrew, and that didn't seem to bother me. What's the problem? You know, and I've still got the frizzy Jewish hair and, you know, the kind of swarthy skin and my cultural background. And I think that religion is very much tied up with culture. And while I love many things about the Tibetan culture, I am culturally a Jewish American. And I'm fine with that. As a matter of fact, I like that. So I can be a Jewish American doing these methods, and I haven't had a problem. And especially when Rinpoche was saying right from the start, I'm giving you these methods, not a religion, I didn't feel that I was torn in any way. So it just hasn't been a problem. After that one moment. So I notice one question keeps popping up for Americans especially. I never get this when I teach in Taiwan. What about running and yoga and, you know, all these health things? Can I just combine all my stuff that's good for myself in one thing and call it? I'm sorry, no. So just as you can do weightlifting like crazy, and it's not going to really help you so much with stretching or aerobics, likewise, those things aren't going to help you with meditation and the benefits that I've been talking about that go on in the brain. The brain isn't behaving the same way when you're breathing hard and running and, you know, stuff is going by, you have to pay attention to, you know, all this other stuff that's going on. You're not doing the same thing, so you're not going to get the same benefit. It's beneficial, but not these benefits. So I'm a big believer in both and. I personally like to jump on a trampoline for exercise. I do not consider it meditation. It's really great exercise, but it is not meditation. So both and. Somebody else asked, how should I work with any intense emotions that surface? So there's more than one answer to this. It's very individual, not just to each person, but to that moment. I don't always do the same thing for myself when I'm experiencing an intense emotion coming up in meditation. Now that I know more intense practices than the one I taught you, sometimes I like to meet fire with fire, you know, and meet that intense emotion with a really intense practice. And that has been just the right medicine in that situation. But in most cases, even within just this one practice that I've taught you, you can treat that emotion like all the other thoughts and sounds and everything else that come and go. Because we all know emotions do come and go. They are not eternal. And what I'm feeling before breakfast isn't the same as the 25 things I'll feel while I'm eating breakfast. There are some that are strong enough that they last longer than that. But even so, just sitting and from that vantage point, watching the play of thoughts, a little bit like an old lady watching children playing in front of her. She doesn't have to get down in the sand and play with them. She can sit back and enjoy what they're doing, see all that's going on, and yet not get right down in it. So we can do that with our emotions. This is not about numbing out. We see the emotions, we're aware of them, and we allow them to move, because they do. They're very fast-moving things, actually, and they'll go through all kinds of different permutations. And we just allow whatever it is to continue and move through, just as we allow the breath to come in and out. So during shamatha, that's a simple thing that you can do. Let's see. Somebody says, I saw in an online YouTube video that you bowed down to a statue of the Buddha. How does this affect or conflict with your Jewish identity? Great question. Fortunately, I have a strong Jungian background. And so that's one reason I was really attracted to Tibetan Buddhism, because they're big on using archetypes for transformation. And of course, that's what Jung was all about. And that's what I was doing in my practice as a therapist and in my own life for myself. It turns out that according to the work of Stephen Kosslyn, he was at Harvard and did years and years of experiments on the brain, and it turns out that the same parts of the brain light up when we look at an object as opposed to just imagining an object. So imagery, I think, is helping us tune into the archetype, because the actual archetype, according to Jung and according to my own experience, I have to agree with him, the pure archetype itself, this principle of reality, if you will, is kind of hard to tune into without using archetypal image or sound. So the image helps us tune into, let's say, enlightened mind. The Buddha is evocative of enlightened mind, but really reminding us of our own innate Buddha nature, that true part of ourself that's a part of the whole ocean. So I need to remind myself again and again, wait a second, I'm actually made of water, part of the whole ocean. I'm not just this separate structure of wave, right? And so doing a prostration does help me to sort of put everything in perspective. Jung talked about self with a small S and self with a large S. Self with a large S is identifying with the whole ocean. And it turns out that is the goal of Judaism, is to expand our ego until we finally embrace everything and everyone as I. Ego means I in Latin. So that's self with a big S. And when we limit our sense of self to just ourselves, that's when we get back to the Dalai Lama saying, if you work for your own happiness, for yourself, that's a recipe for misery. If you want to be happy, work for the happiness of others. This is why. This is why that works. Because reality actually is set up this way, that we're not separate. And the more we can expand our sense of self, the more we're in tune with how things actually are. And we can all understand that the more we're in tune with how things actually are, the happier we're going to be. If our reality is really not matching with real reality, we're going to hit the wall at some point, and it's not going to be comfortable. So it's what I imagine is when I'm prostrating to this image that's evocative of enlightened mind, and the Tibetans understand that that's what it is. They're using it just the same way. And it's not just any old enlightened mind, it's also my enlightened mind. So then it's my ego, which they feel is in the brain, bowing down to enlightened mind or self with a capital S. So it's bringing ego in right relationship. It's not about getting rid of ego. That's a misunderstanding on many people's parts. Kind of like the meditation is hypnosis idea, self-hypnosis. You don't have to get rid of your ego. It can be in service of greater good. It can be in service of the larger intent, which is compassionate and loving and for the benefit of all. And I should also mention, prostrations are really great exercise. I've done it in hotel rooms when I haven't had a chance to do anything else. It's actually, I showed a prostration to a Qigong master, and he said it's fantastic for circulating the prana or qi or whatever in a really healthy way. Excellent. So there are all kinds of reasons to do prostrations, and as I said, the basic goal and what we're actually doing is not at all in conflict with what my rabbi taught me. So one person is asking, do you ever close your eyes completely? The time I close my eyes is when I'm doing a visualization, because I'm busy, you know, setting up that visualization. But for shamatha, in our tradition, we leave the eyes slightly open. And, of course, if you're looking down, they're only slightly open. But the reason for that is that it allows light to come in and light up the brain. And it's also because the goal of meditation isn't just to keep it on the cushion, but to apply it to life. And so if we have our eyes just a little bit open during meditation, then that sets up the right habits so that when we're in normal life, we're applying what we've gained in meditation. So I hope that makes sense. So one person has a technical question. My mouth gets very dry and my back gets tense. Suggestions on how to handle this. Very practical. Because our mouths are open and the breath is coming through the mouth, this can happen. And swallowing is not only permissible, but I highly recommend it. So that can help, you know, just circulating the saliva. And a little singer's trick I learned, because I have background in singing, is gently pressing your tongue between your teeth. And you'll notice that causes more saliva. So if you need more, that's something you can do. And if your mouth is dry in a tense situation and you don't want to sound tense, just do that same trick. As for your back getting tense, I would suggest again and again, no matter whether it's getting tense or it's getting slouchy, because those are the two most popular things to do, as time goes by, you're probably going to be doing one or the other. It's quite possible to do both. Just check in. How is my back now? And remember the marionette, which is very relaxed, supple, yet straight. And that makes sense because then your vertebrae are like a column, so it would take less strain on any particular muscle to hold your back up. So a straight, relaxed back is actually the most efficient way to hold it for a long period of time without getting sore in one spot or another. It also helps the right chi or prana to flow the way it needs to, which adds to the calm yet aware and focused experience that we're going for in meditation. So here's one. How can meditation help with rejection and frustrations in daily life? So this is something I think all of us experience. I certainly do. And I'm going to start small and then go big. And I think that's actually wise. It's good policy. So in the moment-to-moment experience of the meditation, we don't have to think about the rejection right now and figure out what to do about it. A lot of our pain comes from replaying that terrible thing that somebody said again and again. This one master said, why do you people do that? It's like if somebody hits you with a stick, do we then hit ourselves with the stick again and again and again? And yet this is a mental habit. It's just a habit. And habits can be changed. There was a time when we didn't have the habit of brushing our teeth, and then our parents taught us the habit of brushing our teeth, and you know, now we can't let a day go by without brushing our teeth. So we can change little habits, bigger habits, and so on. And I can tell you from personal experience, I used to do the hitting myself with a stick again and again. I would brood and replay again and again. And now I'll do it a little bit, knowing that I'm trying to understand, okay, how can I learn from this and what can I say to this person later? And I only do a little bit of it, and then it's like, yeah, we're just replaying. It's enough of that. And I can let it go. Why? Because if I've been letting thoughts go again and again and again, 1,000 times every time I sit down to meditate, I've developed that habit. Those grooves are there in the brain. And it really stands me in good stead in everyday life. So I can do it on the cushion and off the cushion much more than I used to be able to. Not perfect, but I really see huge improvement, and I think you will too. Let's see, how are we doing on time? We have 15 minutes. Okay, maybe I have time for another question. So during, could you please address mantra versus no mantra, eyes open versus eyes closed? So I mentioned the eyes part, but as for the mantra, in this meditation, there's no reciting of a mantra. You're just experiencing. You know, there's plenty of mantra recitation in Tibetan Buddhism, don't get me wrong. But in this particular meditation that I taught you today, you're just focusing on the ongoing experience of breathing. Eventually we pick the other senses. We're just working with the senses. So the ongoing experience of sound, whatever sounds come and go, we just focus on those. I think in San Francisco it's a great place to focus on sound. Lots of opportunity. But we don't need to produce sounds by doing mantras for shamatha. I think that addresses that. Mantra is another way to tune into these archetypal presences, these principles of reality. Like, you know, the Great Mother is one archetype, one principle of reality. And so there's an image of Green Tara or Yum Chenmo. Yum Chenmo literally means Great Mother. And sort of the higher octave of that is Green Tara. And there are other sort of a whole pantheon of different archetypal images for different principles of reality. And each of them has their own mantra. So that way, you know, since it's, we don't seem to have a channel changer for changing realities and tuning into these principles of reality, we use archetypal sound and image to help us do that. And in my personal experience, it's really effective. So this question is, did you spend time with the Dalai Lama? What is your impression? I have been fortunate enough to meet with him a couple of different times and actually work with him on something for Tibet Children's Village. And what was my impression? It was good. hence the name of the book. But I think the best way to describe it is actually from before I even met him, but I had been in like small rooms with him and larger gatherings with him. And I just noticed when he was present, when he was there, tears would jump into my eyes. It was just kind of like, what's this? What's going on? And so a few of us were, you know, sitting there talking about it. Well, what's the deal? Because other people were noticing the same thing. And, you know, I'm normally not a terribly sentimental person or anything. I'm not one to cry at the drop of a hat and things like that. So I was like, what is going on? And this one fellow, I think, put it really well. He said, the Dalai Lama is an example of how we human beings can be. We've just got some stuff in the way, and he got his stuff out of the way. And so there he is, being what a human being can be. So that's my impression. All right, so now what we're going to do is I wanted you to be able to walk out of here again tasting that peaceful, resting sort of feeling. And shamatha, at least the Tibetan, shine, means calm abiding or peacefully resting, something like that. So on this Saturday, I wanted you to have another taste of that and be able to just sort of waft out of here feeling aware and awake and peaceful, heartful, and hopefully more truly yourself. So we'll do a few minutes, and then I'll ring the bell, and I'd like you to just savor, listen to the bell until there's no more sound. And no need for applause, which will be a little bit jarring. You can just sort of waft out. So again, assume the position. Why this chair isn't facing all of you very well. And again, remember that marionette hanging from the ceiling. So it's pulling up a little bit. So the jaw naturally drops and comes in just a little. Your mouth is a little bit open. Tip of the tongue touching where the upper palate meets the teeth. And bring your awareness, first of all, to the focus that the mind is in the heart. Just try that on for size. And from there, pay attention to the ongoing experience of breathing. thoughts can come. And if we don't mess with them, they often go. And we let them go. We don't have to think about that one now. Breathing is happening. If anxiety about the future comes, or frustration about the past, we can say, I'm all right, right now, and come back to breathing. Perhaps you can feel being one little wave, part of the whole ocean. And you come back to breath. So just savor this last moment or two. Thank you.
Our thanks to Lama Tsomo for being with us today. We are also thankful to our audience here, as well as to those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 113th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.